Hello, page turners. Once again, this is an episode of Outside the Pages. We are here. We are, first of all, congratulations to us, to all of you listeners and to us. This is officially our first episode of season four. I know our seasons are kind of short, but I feel like it makes it a little bit easier. We did it. And now we're doing Matt Fraction. But before we kick off into Matt Fraction, this is our stop in with Ed Brubaker. We're going to cover all of his Ethan Reckless books. And eventually, I definitely want to do a Brubaker season two. I think, Chaz, you thought about that too, because there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about with his books. He's real good. And the stuff going on kind of right now in the news, I'd love to show Ed some love, because I really hope Marvel's paid him by now. Like, because, I mean, what Jim Starlin said is you kind of just make some noise and they'll pay you off so they you're not making noise. And I feel like, I mean, he went to the New York Times and some pretty big, unless they're pissed because he went to big outlets.
Yeah, instead of like CBR.
Well, it's a bold power move.
Yeah, instead of going like CBR, he just went somewhere small. I mean, if.
Or even like, what is it, Heat Vision? He could have gone Hollywood Reporter. That would have been a nice, like, comics adjacent, but still multimedia facing.
The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Yeah.
Yeah, is what Jim Starlin said. I mean, I found out only because I searched comics on accident without any other text in my Google search, and then that article came up immediately. So it was, if you search comics, you would have led you to that link. But I'm super.
You're like, what is our podcast about? Comics.
Comics.
Yep.
I've always wondered what these things are.
We've been talking about them for three seasons, and I think it's time we finally figured out what it is.
Let's just go in-depth about, like how they originated, their, you know, their monomythic past, you know, how...
Honestly, how that Greek, could be kind of fun, just Greek do a full episode on the crash course history of comic books and comic book culture.
We'll cover the what is it, Scott McCloud books.
Yeah.
We'll do Understanding Comics and others.
Should we just, when we get a little bit older? Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, there we
That's
go.
That's awesome. Maybe if we get a little older in like 10 years, we can just cover all of Prince Valiant when. No, Justina.
I don't
just,
know. Just, I'd rather do the Spirit.
I'd rather do the Spirit. But Prince Valiant's still running. Prince Valiant, I believe, is still running.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think you guys could tell I was joking that we'd eventually have to cover Kirby and Stan.
Oh, hell yeah.
That wouldn't be that hard. I think we could do that.
You don't think so?
It's nowhere near as long as Prince Valiant.
Way too much to cover.
Not really. I mean, there's a lot, but if we do them by like character creation, we could kind of like split it up so it's manageable.
It'd be a whole episode, though, about the drama of
between Kirby and Stan.
Well, no, between like ownership, right? And that kind of brings us back around on Brubaker and how he created the Winter Soldier, tied him into a previous existing character in one of the greatest reveals of comics history, at least modern comics history. One of the greatest runs of
Marvel. Blew me away when it happened.
Yeah, like one of the like just really good moments of like, wow, everybody likes the way that they did this. And now is like reaping the benefits of what a work-for-hire contract really looks like. You know what I mean? It sucks.
And they should just like want to pay Ed for the fact that he's done something which pretty much no writer can do. He had a completely successful run for 8 years that was good the whole time. That was never like, oh, I got to get off. And I mean, you could say there's ups and downs. I would say most people would probably say that when Bucky takes over. But I actually enjoyed Bucky Cap. I didn't have an issue with it. And then I even enjoyed the miniseries of Captain America Reborn. I don't know if y'all remember that, but that was all part of his run. I mean, there's like I feel like most people like even Slott had a longer run on Spider-Man, 10 years, and it was mostly good. But there's a lot of like areas you completely skip. Where I was like, if you have the time to maybe read all of Ed's Captain America because it's all pretty good, you could probably skip some of it too, obviously. But this brings me to something I did want to bring up where I'm torn on something else with Marvel. Marvel's just taking shots right now. They're like releasing a lot of stuff. I love that every time a news story comes out with them, they release like a trailer, which is when the Ed news came out. I think this is one the day they released the second Shang-Chi trailer. So they're using Shang-Chi right now.
It's like a
to distract. Well, yeah, they're distracting people. So they released a second Shang-Chi trailer when the Ed Brubaker New York Times story came out to be like, look away from this. Look at our Shang-Chi trailer.
Classic.
And then this week on Friday, they are sued by Scarlett Johansson, and they decided to release a very clearly... Yeah, I'll get into that. But the funnier part of it all is they made a Shang-Chi poster, which looks like it was made in 5 minutes because it's all Photoshopped. It's probably the worst poster they've ever done. And they released it just to distract people with, like, look at this featurette and poster. And then you look at the poster and you're like, what the hell is this? And it's just like Marvel PR being like, shit, we gotta distract, gotta distract.
We gotta get some stuff out.
You would think they'd have a poster before that. Maybe they're working on it and it's not released yet, and that'll be like the main movie poster. But this poster, I surely hope, is not the one going to movie theaters. It is just a distraction. I hope I don't get flagged for this, but I kind of see both points on this lawsuit. Scarlett Johansson is suing Marvel because... We'll get into Ed Brubaker, guys. Sorry, well, this kind of relates because he's also kind of upset with Marvel.
Well, comics news is important.
She's suing Disney, which is technically Marvel. She's suing Disney because if Black Widow would have made $1 billion, which, first of all, I highly, highly question if it could have done that. Not even in this state. Okay, so if it hit $1 billion, she would have got a $50 million bonus. They never asked her permission to put it on Disney Plus Premier Access. So she's stating in the lawsuit that because they didn't ask her about the Disney Plus Premier package, the reason it's not going to hit $1 billion and probably only make $500 million is because they put it on Disney Plus. And she only got $20 million up front, and she's still going to get percentages from, you know, all of its plays and all the normal stuff. The percentage, she's still going to get a good chunk of percentage from the profit the movie's making. But she's not going to get any of the Disney Plus money, which obviously I get to see that's upsetting. And she's not going to get her $50 million bonus because it's not going to hit the billion. So the lawsuit is basically stating that it would have probably hit the billion if they didn't put on Disney Plus. And Disney Plus kind of came out. I mean, Disney came out and said, they're no holds barred. This isn't like we love Scarlett. They said she's basically being ridiculous. We paid her $20 million up front. And the reason we put it on Disney Plus is because of the COVID pandemic, which she doesn't seem to really care about. Which is my kind of thing of, I don't think, because of COVID, not because of Black Widow, but if it was released just in theaters and not on Disney Plus because of, I mean, the Delta variant's really big right now.
I don't think it would make a billion.
People are getting scared again to go to theaters. They're pulling movies again right now. Yeah. Like, it's starting to look like starting to strap down again, which sucks. I really don't want to... I'm starting to do a good job this week, and I don't want to start for 2 weeks and have to go work at home again. I'm having those feelings back of March last in 2020 of being like, am I going to start this new job and work for 2 weeks and they're going to send me to work at home? Because I'm actually looking forward to being out and like going to other parts of town. I just feel like that people need to get vaccinated.
Before we come back.
Yeah. And companies now are forcing it, which is good.
Yeah. Before we come back into the Scarlett Johansson lawsuit, because I do have something to say about that. Out here, all of the local, like, bars and, you know, nightlife have they opened back up. And even with a lot of the employees vaccinated, they still got hit super hard over the last week with Delta. And, like, all of them have shut down because their staff.
I heard from
hospitals filling up around here.
Celeste told me that the Brass Rail opened and they had a show on Saturday. And I didn't know that they have alcoholic kombucha on tap now, but because of COVID, they didn't have anyone running the bar. So I guess people were just self-serving from the bar, and she was sick from the kombucha. What? Yeah, I just thought that was dangerous. That's a...
the Crazy Horse, Elixir, the Coopers, all of them, Mineshaft, they all just got hit with COVID, the staff completely. Even vaccinated people.
All right, back into Jack. You had thoughts on Scarlett.
Yeah. I got thoughts too.
All right.
Yes, Scarlett Johansson is kind of being ridiculous as far as the $1 billion mark. I don't think this is fucking Endgame. I think it's the Black Widow. But also, I do see why she's upset that they didn't tell her it was going to be on the streaming service. Because that's fucked up. It must have been in the fine print somewhere for them to get away with it, though.
No, they have weird contracts. That's a huge part of the article, is that they have, like, coercive contracts, they call them, where it's, like, not in it, but it states also that they can do it. I haven't read the contract. Yeah.
They can do whatever they want. Yeah, exactly. So if she had her lawyer should have been able to figure that out, though. Okay, so anyway. I think that she's being ridiculous about the $1 billion, but I think that Disney was being super shady about the streaming.
Yeah, definitely.
But also, I don't think it should really play a part in the lawsuit, but I do wish she would be more conscious of the COVID pandemic becoming real bad again. Okay, yeah. That's what I have to say.
Yeah. From what I had heard, the contract would have been renegotiated if they were moving it to stream. Like, she had it in there that they were going to renegotiate her contract if they were going to do the dual release model. And they didn't renegotiate with her. They just did the dual release model. So she could have renegotiated then for a portion of the like box office, essentially, from streaming. But because they didn't renegotiate with her, that's where she's like coming in with this breach of contract, because she would have made way more on the back end. The $1 billion mark, definitely pretty high, but after what felt like a drought of cinematic content, and especially of superhero-ness, right? Like, we've all become accustomed to getting three of these movies a year almost, right? Early February-ish release, a May release for the summer, and then a late year
release,
right?
Definitely, I agree with you that.
And then the relentless, yeah. just like yeah. pushing back. I see it making more than it would have just for the sheer fact of being the first one out. And then, of course, the whole world turned to shit again, because that's the way it works with 40% of America or whatever, or more.
I guess it's more.
But yeah. Yeah. But, well, whatever.
It should get less, though, because companies are forcing it now. I mean, I'm really worried with all these companies, you know, which they're right. Honestly, it should be a government mandate. I don't think we should mm-hmm. control the masses like that necessarily. But the fact of this, especially me with a child, we got to get this shit handled. You know what I mean?
And I do really love the idea of the Venn diagram that I'm building in my mind of the people that would refuse to get a vaccine to keep their job, but also be really upset at everyone who doesn't go to work and gets government money. Like, they would immediately become the people in the other bubble that they hate. They would skip the middle.
Same people, yeah.
Altogether, yeah. Yeah.
My main point is all these things are happening and we have these stars. That what troubles me about the Scarlett Johansson thing is she obviously made that $50 million for Endgame and Infinity War. That means she made $100 million of just those two movies. She got $20 million up front. That's $120 million. Okay, difference here. Robert Downey Jr., who is a deadhead, not going to say deadheads are better than other people, but they're usually more conscious about the environment. Robert Downey Jr. is a vegan. Robert Downey Jr. does not do drugs anymore, which is good. Robert Downey Jr. donates huge portions of his money every year to different foundations and things for climate change and for people that are in need and recovering drug addicts. You don't see that with Scarlett Johansson's money, and that's fine, but that's so much money, and we have so many people not doing enough, and someone that literally I could see on paper her making $100 million just herself and then wanting more. I mean, I understand they breached her contract, but people with this amount of money should be doing more. Some are, some aren't. And where we are right now, where people are dying because of a pandemic, the world's fucked up because of a climate crisis, and so many people just don't give a fuck. And I'm raising a kid that's going to have to live through all of our fucking decisions, which, I mean, I just don't want this to be a hell planet for her or for anyone else's children or for anyone. And the fact that we're not doing something when we can is just really, really frustrating. And then people are squabbling about $50 million more dollars when they're clearly okay. Is she going to donate that $50 million to someone else? No, she just wants $50 million more dollars. And the lawsuit's a $100 million lawsuit. So that means what happened to the other $100 million you just made 2 years ago? Is that gone? Like,
She got to support Colin Jost.
That's what I'm going to say.
He's Colin handsome Jost. And funny. He doesn't make money.
He's got a wild lifestyle.
Yeah, probably. The Saturday Night Live guys, you know?
Oh yeah,
that's my mini rant. I just kind of think it's kind of petty for people to be arguing where our world's currently at over millions of dollars when they already have clearly millions upon millions of dollars. But it's more money than any me, you, or Chaz will probably make in our entire lives, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's more than some countries make in their entire lifespan of someone. But we're here to talk about Friend of the Devil. Great name. It's a Grateful Dead song name. A song about Neil Cassidy. This book, surprisingly, has little to do with Neil Cassidy. But it's a fantastic book. It's our second Ethan Reckless book of five. Real quick, I want to shout out Ed Brubaker for winning an Eisner last week for Friday, which is an incredible digital series, which I've been sending copies to you and Chaz. Mm-hmm. I hope you've been reading them. They're real good. Him, Marcos, I think it's, no, it's Marcos Martin. Martin's what I always pronounce wrong. And Munsta Vicente.
Little accent.
Yeah, they're awesome spin on what happens if Encyclopedia Brown's best sidekick that was a girl kind of became the lead of her own story. And it's beautiful. I'm real excited. And definitely November, I'm getting the print edition of the first four issues, which is awesome. And then also it's supposed to be ongoing, which is crazy, which means I might be 50 when it ends because the issues kind of come out every 1 to 6 months. So, which I understand Marcos is working on another, he's working on Universe as well and that book, and his art's great. So I'm sure it takes some time. But if you're a Brubaker fan, go to Panel Syndicate. You could pay literally nothing or pay $2. You could download each issue. It's well worth it. Panel Syndicate's run by Marcos Martin. It's a great indie company that releases all these books digital. And then Image usually releases them in print, especially if they're really popular, like Friday. But Friday is just great if you're a fan of Martin's work. He worked on The Private Eye, one of my favorite books. He worked on Daredevil. He's worked on a lot of big books. It's probably his best art, in my opinion. It's got such like a gothic but fun mood to it. And Friday Fitzhugh is such a great lead character. And Lancelot Jones, her Encyclopedia Brown, is a great character too. And the second issue has a great part where they go through all the book covers of all their adventures, and the art is just through the wall for me. That just reminded me of reading Encyclopedia Brown as a kid, and seeing Marcos's interpretation of all these covers was just so fun and so many adventures I wanted to go on, which, yeah, it just makes me, I mean, if they go back ever and do those adventures, I'd read all of them. Congratulations, Ed, though, and congratulations, Marcos, and congratulations, Munsta. I hope I'm pronouncing Munsta's name right. I think I'm always pronouncing it wrong. Is it Munsta? Maybe one day we'll find out. But I love this book. I'm hooked on Ethan Reckless. I can't wait for Destroy All Monsters and the two books that follow it. I think for now that's it. I don't think that's going to be the end of the series. I think he's going to do this for a while. We'll get into this plot details, but this was really fun for me. And it was the same because it was investigative, but it was very different than the last story to me. And this one really kind of tackled kind of Ed themes he's done before, which are cults in Hollywood. But... yeah. Loved it.
I really loved.
How'd you guys feel?
I really loved the how it was completely a noir, but
yeah,
in you know the style of it and like the setting and the characters and everything about it felt completely you know unique and different for the most part. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed how this one focused more on the investigative process and like having all these really thin leads that end up leading to the bigger leads for most of the book until like pretty much the end, where the one before I felt like was more focused on action and it was easier for him to get from point A to point B. They were both really good, just different. What about you, Chaz?
This is going to be a hot take, and I don't want it to come off the wrong way. This very much fell into the, like, the sequel not being as good as the first one for me. Like, the first Reckless book, the case is so personal, right? And, like, so for me, that first one, really, we got to learn so much about Ethan. We got to see his skill set. We got to watch him be real badass and be the hero. It was awesome. And then in this one, it's removed from that personal element, I think, in a way. And we still get to see just how badass Ethan is and how cool Brubaker and Phillips like bring this character to life and the enemies that he faces and that idea of cults and Hollywood and all of that. And it moving forward into the 80s, I think it's a good setting for it. But I remember thinking, like, after I read it the first time, being like, that was cool, but not as good as the first one. And I know the next one is going to be awesome because I reset my bar. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I think number one put it up, like, way high. And this one was, like, didn't quite hit it, but was almost there. So I liked this one a lot, but not as much as I liked the first one.
I think seeing that there was like a advertisement at the end for the next book, maybe we're seeing the beginning of it becoming slightly more serialized. I don't know if it's just supposed to be three or if there's going to be a continuation with more stories, but that's
kind of
what I'm feeling with it.
There's five in a row.
Okay.
So we got the third one. Okay. And then same kind of distance. So about 6 months, we'll get the fourth one. Another 6 months, they'll do a fifth one. And then I forgot to say, once again, he's collaborating with his number one collaborator, Sean Phillips. And of course, Sean's son, Jacob, is doing the lovely colors. So they're going to do this and then another new project at Image, where they've been kind of for a while since they signed their contract in 2013, which is, they got a cool contract there. They can get whatever series they want without even a pitch, which is a good contract. So basically anything these guys want to do at Image, they can do, no matter what it is. And they scored that after Fatal. Cool. Yeah, and before Fade Out. Fade Out was the first book under that contract. But I can see where it's definitely a different tempo, this one, Chaz. So I can see that. One of my favorite parts of this story is I kind of forgot Ethan's a monster, because let's admit he's kind of a monster. Then in this book, I completely forgot about it, because it's a lot. It definitely touches more of his softer side. He has a relationship this book. He definitely is more emotional because he's trying to do something not for money, literally for just for someone he cares about. And I mean, technically the first one he's doing something for he cares about too, but I don't know. I feel like the relationship was old in the first one and it was kind of reignited, but you never really saw him with Rainey in the first one in the heat of the passion, where this one was kind of in the heat of the passion. And by the end, when you finally see that monster come out, I completely forgot about it. And then I went, oh yeah, this guy's a monster. Like, I was actually worried for the character at the end until I went, why am I worrying? He's going to kill everyone.
the scene in the gymnasium. Yeah. Like, that was the scene where I was like, oh, fuck, that's right. He is, like,
exactly, real, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. He's real trained, and he's real fucking brutal when he needs to be. Yeah. I'm going to end this fight by scaring just the straight piss out of him.
There's somewhere it deviates incredible. From the classic noir format. Is like, instead of it being, you know, like the hard-boiled ex-cop who's probably just calling the police at the end, might shoot some people. Instead, it's like a highly trained, you know, trained ex-FBI who can murder the fuck out of people and has no problem doing it.
Well, Brubaker's own description when Reckless was coming out, which I think is perfect, is he described Ethan Reckless as a criminal sociopath with a sense of justice. which is the good description of the, of the character.
Kind of Sherlock Holmesy. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get in the story so more context. This one opens up in 85, the year I was born, and Ethan hates this year. Mostly, one of the best things I want to point out really in the beginning, if you guys have the book near you or if you remember it, is I love Sean Phillips and Jacob, and a scene that really gets me is how much emotion they put in their characters. And just Ethan looking back, and he's talking about how crack, which is a huge problem in 1985, was running through South Central. And Ethan, even though he's looking back at skinheads chasing him, he kind of, that story element with him looking back kind of, you know, sad and distraught and disappointed is just kind of the perfect alchemy the words and art come together with for me. And it starts out with just a beach scene in Huntington Beach, where one of my best friends lives, who's from the OC. And there's a reason they're in the OC, which is something we've brought up before with Expectandel about the secret darkness in OC. But he's getting chased by skinheads.
Huntington Beach is beautiful, though. Let me add that.
It is. It's gorgeous. Yeah. He's getting chased by skinheads, and then it flashes back, and he meets someone named Lynn Tran. She's a Vietnamese librarian, and he's looking for a guy, a scumbag, that kind of ran away from his family and faked his death. So he's looking through the newspapers he was reading right before he basically faked his death to get a new identity, and they hit it off, and they're kind of the spark to this story, their relationship in the beginning.
Femme fatale, if you will.
She's kind of too sweet for a femme fatale, but she's like the femme fatale role. She basically substitutes that instead of someone coming and taking the place of like, hey, come look for this person, because Ethan's kind of in a funk and watching a bunch of random movies because his dad passed away and old TV shows. And after their first few dates, and then I'm gonna go back so we can talk about this part of the story. Their first few dates, she sees a film where her missing stepsister is in it, and she's missing for 8 years. And Ethan, because he feels a lot of good emotions towards Lynn, they're hitting it off, and he really is empathetic towards her because he really does like her. He says he'll look into it, and that's our story. That's what kicks everything off in this story. He meets someone, they start a small relationship. And then she sees her missing stepsister on a film Ethan's watching, and that kind of takes him into the deplorable parts of Los Angeles and Hollywood.
I do want to add part to Lynn's character, because she's a great character.
Add whatever you want. I was just starting the story a little bit.
He originally, okay, so I think it's great that Brubaker, he obviously knows LA well. Living in Long Beach, it was especially a big thing. During the Vietnam War, they started sending over tons of Vietnamese refugees, and that's where why there's like such a huge Vietnamese community in Long Beach and other parts of Los Angeles. And so he originally thought she was a refugee, and then later found out that her father was from the military, which I guess kind of ties into Brubaker's origin story, which we'll have to bring up. And yeah, and there's, I just think it's cool that they tied that in, and that's actually like something a lot of people don't know about with LA. So yeah, boat people, which I think is pretty racist and bad, but they even used that term. I was like, oh, I haven't heard that in a long time. Glad I haven't. But he used that term from a guy that gets the shit beat out of him for being racist.
Yeah, I really think that there's super organic storytelling going. Like, we get the one case that draws him into the library to meet this woman that kicks off the actual main case that he takes on over the course of this book, which is just really good. Like, the last time somebody came to him, and then there we go. We're in it, you know? Yeah. So him meeting somebody and then just not being able to let it, like, rest, right? They, in my mind, there are two ways that they could have done it, right? Lynn could have said, I want to find my sister. I want to know what happened to her. What went down, right? But also, in a way, I'm sure she would have made her peace with it by then, that she's gone, that there's no more, right? That there's no way that she's out there living somewhere, right? So, like, it's almost like a self-destructive behavior of Ethan's, right? I'm going to go find out what happened to this woman. And either way, it's going to destroy my relationship with Lynn.
Definitely, yeah.
But I have to do it because that's the guy that I am, kind of thing. And also, that opening, like, the sum up that you gave it was great, but it's so fucking choice. Like,
it's the awesome.
Everything that he's talking about, like, about the 80s and how much it sucked and he hated it, basically, and then it ends with him saying, like, talking about the differences between crack and the differences between coke that all the Hollywood people are doing. And he says, that's what I remember about 1985. And then the next page is that and the skinheads. For some reason, there always had to be skinheads. And I love that that's like a new hallmark of a Brubaker book. It's like fucking shitty skinhead people. You know what I mean? Pulp, skinheads, reckless, skinheads. They're fucking everywhere forever. Like, the idea that they're new is wild. That people are like, I can't believe they come out of nowhere. And it's like, nah, man, they've been there. They just fucking suck no matter what. So then getting to watch Reckless go fucking hard on all them fucking deserving idiot neo-Nazis, like, hell yeah. I'm about it, but...
I agree. And even the action, that seems perfect. Just opening up with him crashed on a beach and just kind of getting all these thoughts out. And his hate and of synth bands and hair metal bands.
What the
bands.
Fuck is happening? And then, like, we flash back. Everything's fine. Here we go. And then by the time the story gets to that point again, it's a full-blown fucking shootout. It's incredible. Yeah. The, like, dudes are blown away with a shotgun. Fucking, it's nuts, man.
We're skipping ahead, but his descriptions in that shootout on the beach when he's just, you know, doing what he does best is so great because he's basically just describing people's reactions when they're about to die and, like, what they do every time when they realize they're about to die. Like, and he's just so nonchalant about it.
He's like, they always freeze up. They see their friends die, and that's what gets them killed.
it's basically summarizes.
That's probably true.
I can only imagine.
For Nazis and killers, if I saw my friend get shot, I'd probably freeze up, and that's what would get me killed that split second.
I definitely just love this character. I mean, I like how we see more of his cast of character. Like, every PI or someone we're following has their group of people that help him, and I love that we get more of that this time. And we get, of course, Frank, who has sadly had a stroke and is now getting force-fed kale by his wife, and Ethan lied about bringing in pastrami from Langer's, which is kind of a famous LA deli. So I love all these little spices of California it always puts in his books. But I really liked Byron, his film nerd guy, which I really hope Byron comes back when he's trying to discover more about this film. He goes to Byron. I just felt like that's a great character, whether it's a, you know, a librarian and like older PI things, but just someone that's obsessed with old film. And I feel like he was pretty young, so he kind of age up with Ethan, but I don't know how many cases Ethan's going to have to be investigating a film, but I enjoyed that element, seeing that, which kind of leads him to other characters.
Here's somewhere it gets real, real weird. Or something real interesting that starts kicking stuff off is the film itself is called The Sirens of Satan. And it ends up that there was only 4 copies ever made, which helps Ethan. That's a big lead for Ethan.
Definitely. I thought it was funny because when they talk about New Galaxy, the film company, it kind of reminded me of old school canon. And then the girl, Verna, who helps him, the casting director, actually left New Galaxy to work for canon. So I'm like, is he referencing canon with New Galaxy? And that's why she left to go work at canon. I'm not sure. And then
probably there were a lot of those like grindhouse horror studios,
and that leads him to like his first two.
It could be anyone.
Lynx, which are Ross Normans and Jay Jeffers, he found out was cut up in the desert. So with Sirens of Satan, and then finding out one of the producers in 82 was cut up and put in the desert, it's already got Ethan kind of having like a bad feeling.
The roommate.
But they don't find out about that yet. That's when Ethan has his big revelation of he knows, like, as Chaz said, he already basically knows it's 8 years. He's probably not going to find this girl, but there's a great scene when he finds out.
Not going to find her alive.
No, But there's that great moment when he knows for sure. When he gets a little bit more information, there's that great scene where he has Anna dye her hair black and dress up as an IRS investigator to kind of hassle Maggie's old landlord, which is great. Just
Yeah.
I can't remember exact words, but he said just look mad. Get just the look records. Angry. Yeah, but like the empathy
finds
we've seen.
Out that she was missing for a few months, between the time that the movie was shot and the time that she last paid her rent. So he needs to figure out where she's been staying because she's obviously was alive until at least the movie was shot.
Yeah, that leads him to the names of like the boyfriend. And her best friend, Sue, which Verna kind of tells him she only knows. He meets this film casting director, Verna, who's like an old, like, cougar type of Hollywood casting director. And she doesn't really remember Maggie, but she remembers Sue, the girl she used to always be with. And she called them Jeffers Girls, who's the murdered producer. And they used to have, like, these like, parties that looked pretty fun. When I was in my 20s, I would have been at that party, those pool parties. They were a good time in the Laurel Canyon.
They looked like it on the surface.
this book, Chaz has read Fatal, I think, has a lot of connections with Fatal for me, specifically the second arc of Fatal that's set in Hollywood and deals with a secret Nazi cult and a film that has people being murdered on it, which is definitely, I feel like, Ed kind of touching on those themes again, but kind of moving it up to, you know, more current day instead of in the
aristocratic snuff underground culture.
Yeah, Ed likes to write about snuff. This is the second time. These are
well, it's an intriguing subculture of really fucked up super rich people.
Sometimes I feel like not even super rich people, right? Like
I think so too.
In my mind, I feel like you could be poor and enjoy it just as much.
Yeah, it would be harder to acquire, but I mean, dark web,
probably torn, cheaper now.
I was gonna say you could star in it.
Yeah,
oh my god,
something real fuck. I mean,
like that Serbian Pisker, film shit.
If Ed Pisker's Red Room is any indication of how much it costs, it's not cheap.
My eyes were bigger than my stomach when it came to Red Room. I thought I was gonna like it a lot more, but boy,
I agree.
I had enough after the second issue. I think. I've seen this enough. I'm good.
It's a little bit too to talk about it. Just a little bit too much. I'm glad you feel that too. I'll give it. I usually like to give 3 to any book, but we'll see. This one was pushed back a little bit longer, which I'm glad it wasn't the month after month. I think is a good maybe split it up.
His art's great. A little more time to forget.
It's weird that was like, that's what I want to do now. I want to know if Red Rooms are real. I mean, creepypasta, dark web stuff. Contacts Ed, which Jack kind of brought up. Well, I read a lot of Ed Brubaker this week, and if we do a season two, we'll talk about it more. But I read Scene of the Crime, and then I read all of Fatal and Velvet, and I enjoyed all of them. Scene of the Crime, which is real good, and that's one of his first books and first collaborations with Sean Phillips, where he just did the cover, and
yeah.
Lark
Michael
did the
Lark
art.
Did the inside.
Yeah. It's kind of just about some easy-go detective that's drawn into a case, kind of just like Ethan Reckless, and I enjoyed that a lot. But all of his books have this perfect noir detective story, which is, it's so enjoyable. Like, it was so good checking in again with Ethan on this, and it's so good to see him go all out. I could see where you didn't like I said, this one's a lot softer than the first one. And the first one's just like an adrenaline shot, kind of.
And
like,
it's not even that I didn't like it as much. It's just, like I was saying, the first one is so personal, right? Like,
yeah.
Ethan is closer to that case. He's close to this case through Lynn, right? But Lynn is a woman that he's fallen for in some just like romantic bliss, right? Like, it doesn't seem like the relationship is the one where he's going to be like, wow, like next book, he's not even going to talk about Lynn.
No,
you know
way.
What I mean?
Yeah. There's just some girl he met that was a short
talk
relationship.
About her, the lady from the first one and this one. But
no.
That's also a couple years later, so maybe that's what. But no, it's still an excellent mystery. It's still perfectly put together. The revelations come just as surprising, I think, each time that I read it. You know, there are a few things that I don't want to say directly, but the moments of revelation, I think, where he's looking at that book, the like packet, I think, the like pamphlet for the cult.
Yeah.
And he sees the thing that kicks him in the mind, like, oh, fuck, I got to go talk to this guy again. And then that spirals out, of course, because that shit was pretty wild. It's still just as shocking, even when I know it's coming. Like, I get the same adrenaline rush of, like, that's the break we needed. That's the part of the case we were looking for. Which I think speaks to the quality of Ed's writing when it comes to noir. And I think Sean's layouts... And even Jacob's coloring, like, just really, really blows it out of the water every time.
Definitely. Like, right before he discovers that on the photo, there's that scene where he finds out about the old roommate and the girlfriend both being dead. And just with their art in his face when he realizes then there's no way Maggie's alive. And just when he then states it's going to destroy both of us whenever it destroys us, because he just knows at that moment, like, he already is pretty sure she's dead, but... As soon as he hears those two are dead, he just knows she's dead too. Like,
yep.
There's no way she's alive. And just the way they convey that, him just going fuck and realizing he stepped into something bigger and darker than he thought originally. This one got me more, what you said about the first record, was like, oh, it's over. Because this one is a little bit softer and slower. That this one, when I realized we're at the conclusion in that gymnasium, I really wished we had more story. Like, it's a great conclusion, but that was when it really hit me, like, I thought there was so much more story left, and I was like, oh, this is it, which is also to the quality of Ed's writing in this work, because I want to stay with the character longer.
Yeah, and I think there was some untold bits, because we do find out a little bit more about the movie itself and the things that happened, right? There's this follow-up scene where he is hunting down copies of the film, and so I almost thought, with how much book we had left, that we were going to see a bit more of that, yeah. But it was... Actually, just enough, I think. Just enough to know the trouble that he went through to put this evil out, to stamp it out all the way. Yeah, they sold it just enough. And then put him right back where he belongs, right back in the theater.
Yeah,
right back with his assistant.
With roughing him up first, too. Like, after he sees the photo and then he goes to that convalescent home to kind of interview the old producer that's in his 60s but looks 80 because he's done too much coke. And then him immediately get captured afterwards by the skinheads. You're like, oh, the skinheads are back. And then the way Ed's writing, too, is so well done. It's, all right, we know Ethan's a monster, but this story's a little bit softer, so we forgot about it. So when he's first tied up and it's black, he's describing about how he was trained for this exact situation. And still, because it's written so well, you just read that. And then you get to your big villain scene where the villain's exposition is the main villain. It's not reveal everything, but the main villain's there and he's just exposition. You know, he's telling everything that's going on and he's basically giving Ethan the resolution to the
story.
The
villain speech.
which is yep. Which is dark. And even though Ed just told you 2 pages ago that Ethan is trained in this, still the handcuff scene works so well. They almost really forget. Does. Like it's just like the guy thinks he has all the power, and then just after he gets what he wants, he just stands up, and it's such a fucking.
Let's go.
Yeah. Like,
whoa.
The perfect line is, "They don't know who I am." If they knew who I was, they would have never brought me here in the first place. Like, just bringing a monster to a gymnasium, like, they would have killed me. They would have never, he would have never had an exposition villain speech if he knew who the hell he was dealing with.
He's a real, he's a gun in a knife fight. Is even, like, they just don't know it yet.
Fucking uses handcuffs as a fucking weapon to disarm people. The guys just, you do not fuck with Ethan Reckless. And he'll get fucked up again and then end right back up in the theater. Like, Chess said. Yep.
I like how they also explain, or when he's doing his exposition, it starts putting a lot of stuff together in a totally different light than you originally see it in. Like, you know a lot of the stuff's going on, but you kind of learn more about why it's happening.
Yeah.
It's like not just pure chaos and for the sake of it, like fucking Anton LaVey shit. There's more going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's a Nazi taking the powers he learned in the SS to America when he went on the run is kind of it. I mean, I think the guy, the villain, just thinks it's all bullshit too, which is kind of just,
exactly.
Ed's story of Ed being a Navy brat that was raised on military bases in Gitmo and stuff and around the country, he had a lot of that inspired his story as he talks about in the book because his uncle was in Vietnam at the time. So he met a lot of Vietnamese people when he was younger, and then also the Satanic Panic, which is a huge thing in the 80s and late 70s, kind of influenced this story, which there were so many people doing these Satan films and being in cults. And I love that he goes, it's the era where hippies turned bad, like when hippies took LSD and then kind of just went too crazy, where the 60s were all peace and love on acid, and then up to the 70s, still kind of peace and love, but by the late 70s, 80s, it's like
definitely,
acid is and just... No, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, I was saying it definitely gave me like Anton LaVey, Aleister Crowley, kind of mixed with like Charles Manson, mixed with Hydra.
Definitely.
Big time.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Premium villains.
Highly recommend. The only thing about the stories is they're kind of short. I feel like we've touched on a lot of stuff without revealing the entire story for people, but I
hopefully
highly, highly recommend anyone checking into this book. I'm really excited for the next one, which kind of had more conversations. I'm curious if we're going to be in the 90s yet or late 80s. I know that Ed said this one's completely different than the first two, which I wonder what that means. The cover is kind of him with a bunch of people in gas masks, so I wonder if it's just a full-on action story. I'm real curious.
I'd be into that.
Yeah,
seeing all the different facets of who he is. Maybe it's even a... I'm kind of hoping at some point... Actually, maybe it probably isn't, but I was kind of hoping at some point to see Ethan Reckless way back when he was doing like all the undercover stuff.
Maybe we will eventually. I know these ones are like successful.
Flashbacks to his training and all that. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I would think it would be pretty cool if it moved forward to the 90s. Cause then, so that'd be 1, 2, 3, we'd be in the 90s. 4 would be 2000s. 5 would be like odd 10. So it'd be like a 60-year-old old man Reckless or whatever, which could be pretty hard thinking
like fucking
Clint Eastwood, Gran Torino. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're right, Chaz, because I think our Chaz is on something, because at the last page of this story, we find out Ethan is telling these stories from 2015.
Yeah.
Because so he said like, 85 was 30 years ago. Yeah.
So that would be a pretty good, like, just 10 years forward almost every volume. But
that's kind of the energy I got from this.
Yeah, there's something about like pre era of technology, pre era of like facial recognition, pre era of the digital everything that makes crime stories better.
Definitely.
You know what I mean? Because like you could really plot, plan, scheme, execute, pull off incredible shit. But now it's like you got to have the fucking best hacker in the world, the super fucking IR, like interference for all the cameras and all this shit. Like,
and that's just you gotta have, interesting, in my opinion.
No, because all it takes, you just got to have some, like, one guy who's a nerd enough to fucking build it all for you. You know? Instead of having, like, I need this dude. He's the fucking most intimidating guy, but he doesn't kill anybody. I just want somebody who's going to look like they're going to fucking blow somebody away and stand up. But, like, we're not going to. We're not that crew or whatever. Like, there's it. It's like a, it was an art almost in every other thing.
Yeah.
In every other crime noir story before that era that, like, makes it more compelling because I think they actually have a chance of getting away with this instead of, well, they left fucking DNA everywhere. That guy scratched his head. That dude picked up a cup. That guy did whatever. They're going to fucking find one dude and then that's it. It's all
cameras.
Like,
literally exactly. Everywhere.
It also yes, just but, makes dude, the investigation so, yeah, more compelling back then because, like, now it's way harder to stretch. It's hard to have Ethan go to 20 people to get investigate a story current day, which is very much on Chaz's point because literally he would just have to start on a computer and then look. Unless he's investigating fucking missing 411 people disappearing out of who nowhere
are
in
gone
the forest.
Forever. Yeah.
He's going to be able to find info pretty easily yeah. through just the web and it.
Picking up that's cold why, cases.
Like,
yeah. Which, so, yeah, so, there's something to be said about not moving it forward, I think, would lead to some pretty compelling shit. But also, I do want to see how he handles the violence. You can't fucking just blow a guy away on a beach in 2000. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's like a pretty, that's a pretty big deal.
Even I mean, here he's getting close. Then, yeah.
But like, well, yeah.
This is all kind of reminding me of a conversation we had way back about The Wire when we were talking a bunch about The Wire. But and how that was, yeah, that was like at the exact perfect time for that show because it was right before all this technology came out. But they still, so they still had to do everything old school with undercovers, wiretaps, obviously The Wire.
What the fuck is Law and Order
know,
like
people
now?
Were using the shows phone booths. Ends.
Because on Jack's know, point, man. Jack, you're right. I'm just like, what?
It's mostly the order part.
Is it
I think.
Still in the 90s?
They still like can catch him, and they're like, we fucking got him, but innocent until proven guilty, right? It's up to the DA.
Yeah, because how like, can they still be looking for
NCIS
rapists on SVU?
With more lawyers.
DNA, yeah, DNA caught him. Like, there's no.
Yeah, then they get the real high powered guest star attorney, defense attorney. Usually it's like Kyle MacLachlan or somebody. And they're like, well, you could see they might have DNA evidence, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't consensual. And then the whole jury's like, and everybody like is like, fuck, how do you have to bring that up? Like, then they go and question him. It's not good.
Speaking of MacLachlan, to talk about future Patreon material, which we'll be launching at some point, is I would just love for us on Patreon either do the works of David Lynch or just talk about Twin Peaks: The Return for maybe just every episode
I
of that.
Talk about Twin Peaks: The Return for
I could talk about David Lynch's Dune
every day, all day. Like
I feel like you could talk about Twin Peaks: The Return for a year straight. It's just so good and so bonkers and perfect and. Man, I wish most sequels to Something Good were like that, where they clearly had no restrictions and just went buck wild and a perfect ending, which is not a good ending. Lynch is just fucking David Lynch is great. He has a music festival,
it's
film
so crazy
festival.
He got funding
he was
for
starring.
All that shit that he made. It's awesome.
Yeah,
I love his stuff.
Yeah.
Or, hey, in the for the sake of noir, we could talk about Blue Velvet. That's a great one.
Fucking hell yeah!
Hell yeah! Blue Velvet. Mulholland Drive. I would even call Mulholland Drive a nightmare noir.
That was supposed to be a Twin Peaks spinoff.
We could talk about we could talk about Eraserhead just for the fuck of it.
I mean, Lost Highway.
Yeah. Was it Wild at Heart?
Anyway.
Wild at Heart. Fantastic. His weird twisted sense of Wizard of Oz. Real quick, David Lynch, as you guys, I don't know if you guys know, is he wrote Lost Highway because of O.J. Simpson. that he, I don't know if you guys have seen Lost Highway or listeners have seen Lost Highway. Yeah, because like the whole part where the guy becomes someone else, because his whole theory was, I don't know how you can cut your wife's head off and then go on living unless you just completely turned yourself into a different person and basically forgot the old you and just completely adapted into a new person. A lot of good movies coming out. I'm excited for Eternals. Good stuff coming out. Hopefully the theaters do not close again, which is my fear. Is that why, which is a huge thing on the internet, real quick, we'll bring up nerd stuff before we wrap up. Everyone's freaking out about No Way Home because there's no trailer yet. Is that because Sony, who just pulled Clifford the Big Red Dog, doesn't want to release a trailer for something that vague in case they have to pull it? I'm very curious if that's why. Or they're that just really...
That's a good guess.
Yeah.
They did Clifford the Big Red Dog movie?
Yes, they pulled. It was supposed to have its premiere at the Toronto Film Festival, which is crazy to me. They pulled it from that, too. But the film festival's still happening. But they said the excuse was is because they don't think families will go to theater. So they might not pull Spider-Man because I think they're more, you know, more teens and, you know, adults will go to that. Is it also just because they can't really show a trailer without revealing the thing that everyone knows, but they're acting like it's still a secret? I mean, how long are they going to act like it's a secret? That Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire aren't in the movie. Everyone knows they're in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're trying to hide it, and they're trying to have Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire say they're not, but then strangely, they're in New York with Tom Holland like every other month for 2 weeks, and they're all there at the same time, and everyone knows they're in the movie. It's just like, why are you trying to hide this so much?
They don't even have it on their IMDb.
They're filming the Doctor Strange scene.
Are they doing... did they pull Clifford because every time they try and do a CGI animal, it is terrifying? Like the what was that one? The Christopher Robin movie that just looked like
that movie made money, horrifying. Dude. They made a sequel.
Really?
The dog looked bad.
Like it was going to give me nightmares.
It wasn't Christopher Robin. It was Peter Rabbit. But wow. Christopher Robin. Does it look good?
No, Christopher Robin with the scary
Ewan McGregor. I was wrong about that. Yeah.
The thought that
It looks just like a dog.
The writer of Pooh Bear was totally writing Christopher Robin to be like schizophrenic, and they probably completely left that out of the movie. But
Clifford's going to be voiced by David Alan Grier.
Yeah.
I didn't know that Clifford could talk.
I didn't think Clifford could talk either. David Alan Grier.
Pretty weird pull, but all right.
Are they going to have an In Living Color like dance at the end? In Living Color! And just have Clifford dancing. After credits scene.
After credits,
I really want to go see The Green Knight real quick. That looks great. David Lowery is a great filmmaker.
It's getting good reviews, too.
Yeah, it looks real cool. Anything new comics related you want to bring up, Chaz? This week I really enjoyed, I would say I enjoyed Department of Truth a lot. And then I also, I didn't remember my list. A lot of books I enjoyed this week. Definitely Barbaric and Blue Flame were excellent again as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if anybody listening out there is not reading Vinyl, it's what I'm going to call a trust me book. Trust me, read it, you're going to like it.
I love Vinyl also. It was my top. It's like Serial Killer Suicide Squad right now, except not Suicide Squad, but Serial Killer Team Up. It's real brutal and real funny. Yeah.
Just a perfect execution. Never, like, very rarely, I think, is there a book as good as this one that has like such a solid premise that just blows up the balloon with every issue. Instead of the like fizzle, you know, you try to blow a balloon up and it doesn't go, you just like...
Yeah.
The whole time. That's how I feel with like some books when I'm like, this book has a fucking great idea. And then every issue that comes out, I'm like, why don't they fucking remember what it is? And then Vinyl is like, every issue is like, here's another one. This is getting pretty big. And I'm like, this fucking idea is just like getting better and better. Like by the time it's over, it's going to pop and I'm going to lose my shit. But like, it's going to be awesome.
I've been loving it. It is my definitely read Vinyl. It's in my top picks too. And Blue Flame.
Yeah, I was gonna say if you like Vinyl, go out and get Plastic. Same team, similar premise, only it's about a man going after his girl, and his girl is a real doll, and by doll I mean sex doll. the sex doll that he's in love with that he thinks is real, who is kidnapped by these evil fucking townies, and he's coerced into doing some shit. And it's another one where it's one of those, like, this idea should not be executed at the level that it is. This is like a Grindhouse idea that should have died in like a D movie shelf. But this is like a fucking A+, like, Watchmen style. I won't say Watchmen, but like, you know how Watchmen TV was like fucking a perfect just run of storytelling? That's like what this is on that, like, holy shit, this idea is like being done so well. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, on my rec, I will say Barbaric and Department of Truth. Everyone's probably reading Department of Truth. It's a great book, but Blue Flame, definitely. I know you, Chaz, like that too. Definitely, if you're not reading Blue Flame, read it. For someone like myself, I don't know if I brought on the podcast a few years ago, I was assaulted and my jaw was fucked up and I had to get well over surgery. It took almost a year. And just kind of the main character dealing with surgery and having to take the pain medication and kind of just being in a rut, and then combining with the fantasy element of a superhero in space, it just really works for me. And this latest issue kind of combines everything with the first two issues. We're kind of trying to figure out what's happening. And this one kind of just blends them all together into one narrative, which I really enjoyed, which I think is kind of the main character's process of getting through what he's going through, which is surviving a shooting and just kind of barely being able to exist and live, and him kind of dealing with that by escaping to a fantasy world. And Chris Campbell himself, great writer, he was kind of dealing with some depression this week, which is sad to see. I got to say, Chris, you're a great writer. You inspire me. Your book's great. People should be reading Blue Flame. And I've also been enjoying United States of Captain America's other book out right now, which is...
And Iron Man.
Well, Iron Man's great.
Every issue.
Iron Man is... This is my favorite Iron Man in years. Like, I'm reading every issue and just on it. It's
my favorite Iron Man since the Fraction run, which we're going to talk about in the coming weeks.
2 weeks. Yeah, it's... The art's great, too, and, like, the way he uses all these D-list heroes that shouldn't even be with Iron Man to create this great cast. Yeah, it's like Iron Man on street level. It's so good. Like, if you're not reading it, definitely check it out. This book was great. And this is, what's great is we're going, this is our Matt Fraction season, and we're just finished this Friend of the Devil, our Check-In with Brubaker, and our first book we're going to cover by Matt Fraction next week is Immortal Iron Fist, which was written by Matt Fraction and Ed Brubaker. They both combined with David Aja to make this kung fu style story, which I can't wait to talk to you guys about. And the week after that, we'll be doing Invincible Iron Man. Excited to do this Fraction deep dive. Excited for November with Aditya. And then we have a lot more special stuff coming up right after that. We're going to have two special episodes. And then we got some cool guests coming on for our Remender run, which I'm really excited to announce a little bit down the run. But we're going to do more stuff with other podcasters for once, which we usually just had comic book people on. We're going to bring on some other podcasters that talk about comics, so it'll be fun. And I'm kind of as nervous about meeting them as I am about comic creators, only because I've been listening to them forever. And I mean, we're funny sometimes. These guys are always funny, but I think that'll make us... I'm worried because they tangent a lot, but their episodes are usually around 45 minutes. So I think... And when one of the hosts asked me, when he said yes, one of his main questions was, how long are your episodes? And I told him... 60 to 90, but he didn't seem to care. But their episodes are usually 30 to 45
minutes.
Sometimes
we go 120 plus.
Yeah,
it varies. But I just feel like our tangents are going to come because they have a lot to say about comics.
Tangential format for podcasting is definitely where it's at, and I think what is the most fun to listen to. So.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I just feel like we got
to... I don't want to listen to scripted podcasts, man.
No. Our tangents are the best.
Let me throw
their
this
tangents
out
are the best.
That I wrote.
But so. Really excited about Fraction, Remender, and our horror books. So, I mean, we're going to have all of our horror books. I'm excited to hear Chaz and Jack's picks. We're going to have a lot of fun with that. Halloween's my favorite time of the year. But next week, we have Immortal Iron Fist. As always, I'm Michael. You can find me on Twitter at PoetAir33. You can find the show at Outside Though with a Zero. And remember to rate, review, and subscribe. And then where can they find you guys?
You can find me on Twitter as well at Chaz Simon.
You can find me on Twitter at sin_aesthetics with an X, or on SoundCloud at sinaesthetic. And I got some big things in the works there. So
we do. We're going to be releasing more stuff. Once again, I must ask you, what is collaborative geometry? And Jess?
Turn the page. Wash your hands. Yeah.
bridges.